the lawmakers. This is a report on the people who make your laws, members of the state legislature and the Congress. In place of our usual interview with Western Michigan lawmakers, we present by transcription a report by Dr. Willis Dunbar, Director of Public Affairs for the Fetzer Broadcasting Company, describing the final meetings of the legislative session at Lansing Friday afternoon and night. Dr. Dunbar.
There were hijinks and comedy, high and low. But there also were earnest talks, hurried conferences, bitter debate, and drama. I'd like to start with the drama. It came to a climax, I think, around 3 o'clock Saturday morning, when bald-pated Fred I. Chase, Secretary of the Senate, wearing a brave purple necktie, announced that the House had approved the conference report on the grand jury bill, and that that report was now before the Senate. This was what everybody had been waiting for. All afternoon and evening, you'd heard it whispered in the corridors and discussed by those in the know that when the grand jury bill hit the Senate, the fireworks would begin. At long last, after hours of rather monotonous grinding out of last-minute legislation, which evoked little debate and almost no heat, here was the big moment. Members of the House came flocking into the Senate. The spectators filled the Senate gallery. The newspaper reporters alerted themselves, and every senator was poised for action. 3 o'clock Saturday morning, with the big clock in the House covered with a cloth, and the one in the Senate covered with a false face, with the hands set at 11:54, because legally the session ended at midnight, May 20th. What was behind this grand jury bill? I tried to find out during the day and evening. As you well know, Michigan has the so-called one-man grand jury system. It's a method of obtaining evidence which cannot be secured by ordinary means. A judge, who sits as a one-man grand jury, decides after hearing argument and evidence whether there is sufficient cause to arrest a person or persons for trial. The one-man grand jury has attained a lot of publicity in Michigan, and its proceedings have made the news headlines month after month on celebrated cases. Why was it criticized and opposed? First of all, labor organizations and the Democratic Party, led by the governor, were in favor of erasing entirely the one-man grand jury system. Their belief is that it enabled one man, sitting as a judge and jury, to disregard the rightful privileges and immunities of citizens. Labor sees in it a means of persecuting labor leaders. But the Democrats alone could not have eradicated the one-man grand jury. A lot of Republicans were against it, too. It goes back to the fact that one Kim Sigler, who was a very unpopular man amongst the legislators, so far as I could judge, attained the notice of the public and was elected governor as a consequence of the publicity which came his way as special prosecutor in one-man grand jury cases. Certain Republicans want to prevent the appearance of another Sigler. This thing had been kicked around almost from the start of the legislative session. The Michigan Bar had come out with recommendations for a modification of the one-man grand jury system. Wednesday night, the legislature had a midnight session on the issue. It was agreed that the one-man grand jury must go. The recommendation of the bar was adopted that instead of a one-man grand jury, three circuit judges should sit in a grand jury case. Certain other modifications had been okayed, but there was one big issue left, just one. It concerned the so-called immunity clause. Now, under the present system, a witness may be granted immunity from prosecution on his testimony before the grand jury. That means that if a crook will turn state's witness, he can escape the penalty of his crimes. Now, there was, I believe, a completely honest and sincere difference of opinion on this matter among the Republicans. The Democrats were, of course, in favor of eliminating the immunity clause because that would come nearer to killing the whole grand jury system as it has operated in Michigan. But the Republicans were split. One group, championed by three of the young freshman senators, all of whom you often have heard on this program, Carlton Morris of Kalamazoo, John Martin of Grand Rapids, and Creighton Coleman of Marshall, firmly believed that if the immunity clause were stricken out, the whole grand jury system was useless. They felt that only by granting immunity to witnesses could the state get the evidence that it needs to try and convict certain wily criminals. These men fought tooth and nail to keep that immunity clause in the bill. But another group of Republicans, mostly older men, mostly veteran senators, were of a different mind. They believed with equal sincerity that the immunity clause is simply a means by which guilty men can escape their just dues by turning state's witness. The leaders of this faction were Senators Tripp, Higgins, and Hiddle. That's the background for the 3 a.m. drama in Michigan's Senate Friday night. When the question was placed before the Senate, Mr. Tripp arose and stated simply that he hoped the Senate would accept the conference report, which eliminated the immunity clause. Senator Coleman stated that he hoped that the Senate would reject the report. And then Senator Higgins arose and explained at some length the exact provisions of the bill now before the Senate, and moved the previous question. That, under the rules, cuts off further debate. Senators Morris and Martin were on their feet at the time, but they were not permitted to speak. The vote was taken. It stood 18-12 in favor of the conference report, with Senators Bonine and Green not voting. But the opponents of immunity were bound to have their say. Senator Morris of Kalamazoo, in an angry speech, asserted that this had started out as a party measure, and he bitterly denounced the Republicans who had agreed in the conference committee to strike out the immunity clause. He said their consciences would hurt them. And he went on to say that without the grand jury system and the immunity clause, it would not have been possible to bring to the bar of justice the men responsible for the Goon Squad raid in Kalamazoo last December. Senator Tripp then replied that he could sleep that night as well as Senator Morris. Senator Coleman expressed himself as being bitterly disappointed at the outcome. And then Senator John Martin of Grand Rapids arose and gave perhaps the most eloquent talk of the night. He said the Senate would rue the day that it took this action, that at some future day the law would be changed. He concluded by saying, "You have committed murder here in the Senate tonight." When he had finished, others were on their feet. Senator Higgins then calmly reminded the senators that the action had been taken, and that tempers were flaring, and proposed a recess. That counsel was rejected, and finally, business was resumed. It was high drama all the way through. There were other tense moments which had an element of comedy in them. In the House, early in the evening, a measure approved by a conference committee caused a long and somewhat amusing series of developments. The bill was one which would have put a 3% use tax on every used car which was sold, either by an individual or by a used car dealer. The argument in favor of this bill was that some used car dealers collect the sales tax on used cars and then don't turn it into the state. This tax would have been upon the use of a car and could not be evaded because it would have had to be paid prior to title transfer. Those opposed to this bill claimed that it was a bad tax, a tax on the little fellow who wanted to sell his car to his neighbor. The Democrats in the House, 39 strong, were solidly against the bill. After some debate, the measure came to a vote. In the House, they have an electrical tally board. A member simply presses a yes or no button on his desk, and his vote is recorded on a big electric board in the front of the House. When the vote had been completed, the members counted the green lights representing yes votes and saw 45. A total of 51 votes are required for passage, a majority of the whole membership of 100. Before the result was announced, a representative got up and began to demand the votes of those who had not voted. Now, in the House, any member may do this, whereas in the Senate, a member doesn't have to vote on a measure unless he wants to. As further votes were cast, they were recorded by the clerk, but not tabulated on the electric board. The yeas gained until at last they had 51, a majority. But before the result could be announced, a member got up and changed his vote from yes to no. Back to 50. Another change from yes to no. 49. Another changes from no to yes. 50. The sergeant-at-arms is dispatched for absent members, mostly in conference committees. They come in one by one and vote yes or no. But the sergeant can't find one member, a chap named John Taskowitz, representing the 3rd Wayne County District. The time passes on. More switching. 50, 49, 50 again, then 51. But quickly back to 50. Where is Taskowitz? Mrs. Taskowitz sits beside his vacant seat quite calm and unconcerned about the whereabouts of her husband. Well, this sort of thing went on for almost an hour. Finally, the yeas sagged down to 48, and the advocates of the bill gave up. Even Taskiewicz couldn't change the results if and when he was found. A few explanations from various members of why they voted as they did, and then on to the next item of business. A little later, your reporter crossed over to the Senate, and on the way, he encountered Taskiewicz. "Are they still looking for me?" he asked. "Oh yes, we won't have to pay that 3% when you sell your car to your neighbor. And what makes all this even more funny and perhaps a bit ridiculous is the fact that everyone was sure that the governor would veto the bill if the House did pass it, and it couldn't possibly be passed over his veto." Speaking of the governor, he was circulating around the two houses with a broad grin and lots of that boyish charm. Now to conclude, a few random impressions of your state legislature in process of winding up its affairs. These men are honestly trying to do a good job. Sure, there's some foolishness, but there also is a lot of hard work and thought. Here, on the last night, compromise becomes necessary. The House gives in on some matters, the Senate on others. A conference committee agrees, and in most cases, but not all, the two houses go along without much trouble. Sometimes, though, there has to be a second conference committee. One is impressed by the crucial role played in all this by the clerk of the House, Norman E. Filio, and the Secretary of the Senate, Fred Chase. Both men know the rules forward and backward. Whenever the presiding officer needs advice on parliamentary procedure, they're able to give it. They are masters of the legislative mechanism, veterans at the trade, highly respected by both parties. Your reporter is indebted to Senator Tripp and Representative Van Valkenburg for inviting him to sit at their desks, and to all the other senators and representatives from Western Michigan who were so thoughtful and helpful in showing him around and making him feel welcome. During the dinner recess, a huge steak at a place called Archie's in the back room with a group of legislators. Parliamentary puzzle. Can you make a motion to lay on the table a motion to take from the table? The answer is no. Senator Tripp sits at the same desk occupied by his father in the Senate from 1915 to 1919. There are two women members of the House, both Democrats, both from Detroit, Mrs. Hicks Griffith and Miss D. Edwards. In a speech, one representative tells another, in anger, that he can go stick his head in a pail of water. Speaker Victor Knox of Sault Ste. Marie calmly calls him to order. Lieutenant Governor John Connolly of Detroit presides over the Senate as if he were terribly bored by it all. But he was quite popular Friday night because he provided a most sumptuous buffet lunch for the senators and their guests during one of the recess periods in his office. Being a legislator is a craft that these men have learned. You wonder how they know what's going on all the time, but apparently they do. Old John Espy, serving his 13th term in the House, very weak, highly regarded by his colleagues as veteran chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. A blind man dispenses soft drinks and tobacco and candy with unerring accuracy in the House. Your reporter had to take off sometime between 3 and 4 and so missed the sight of Governor Williams calling a square dance for the legislators and their committee clerks with Senator Bud Tripp at the piano. Seeing the legislature in action on the last night of the session is quite a show. It's surprising more people don't go and see it. There was plenty of room in the galleries almost all night. For your reporter, it was a most interesting experience.
You've been listening to a report by Dr. Willis Dunbar on the adjournment session of the legislature held in Lansing Friday afternoon and night. Next week at this time, we'll bring to our microphone State Senators John Martin and Perry Green of Grand Rapids with their views on the accomplishments of the legislature during the past session. We invite you to listen also to that regular weekly talk of Governor G. Menin Williams on state affairs, heard over this station each Wednesday evening at 11:15. This has been another program presented in the public interest by the Fetzer Broadcasting Company.